Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Kate Andrews and Fraser Nelson. On midnight on Saturday, the city of Preston was added to the list of other northwestern cities in England that have had restrictions resumed because of coronavirus. Fraser, it's not a full lockdown, but like other areas in Greater Manchester, no two households can meet indoors. Why has it been locked down?
Because a number of infections have reached levels that the government are worried about. I think it's just higher than 40 per 100,000 population. Now, that's not wildly dangerous. In Germany, the safe threshold is regarded as 50, but it's a lot higher than the rest of Britain, and any upwards movement leads the government to take action. The big question, though, is whether there is actually more COVID or simply more testing. When Leicester was locked down, it was an open question. Public Health England published a very detailed rapid response report saying that, yes, there's been more testing, but that doesn't necessarily mean to say there's more disease, because you would look at the hospital numbers. Now, very few people were being hospitalised by COVID at that stage. Was it going to increase? Public Health England said you'd only know in Leicester in 2 or 3 weeks' time. But as it later turned out, a study in the British Medical Journal showed that there wasn't any increase in hospitalisations in Leicester. In fact, they halved. Now, that gives us the question of Preston. Do we necessarily think there's more COVID or simply more testing? When we looked at this in The Spectator, we summed up, you can get the figures now for the northwest of England. That's not just Preston, that's Greater Manchester, Cheshire, Cumbria. We can look at the whole area. And at the peak, there was something like 400 hospitalizations per day. On the last available published data, there were just 4. So that is a 99% decrease. So there isn't any increase in the northwest in COVID hospitalizations. That raises questions as to how much of the virus actually has increased versus something that could have been manufactured by an increase in testing. Now, I also notice that when, in the case of Leicester, Public Health England did release a very detailed, very honest report. In Preston, there hasn't been any such report published. We know very little about why the government has closed it down, other than the number of tests has gone up. It has not published the Preston hospitalizations. I suspect because that figure is going to be pretty low, because let's face it, if there were just 4 in the whole of the northwest, there are likely to be even fewer in Preston as a city itself.
Now, Kate, if we're using hospitalisation as the measure, isn't that just a function of who is getting infected here? Preston is saying that almost half of the infected are under 30, so naturally they might have milder symptoms. But if they do pass it to older generation and it is more prevalent in society, then maybe hospitalisation isn't the best measure for how badly an area is being hit.
It's absolutely the case that young people can pass this on to elderly people who are much more likely statistically to suffer severe symptoms. But it does show us how much the goalpost has moved. We were told at the end of March that we were going into lockdown to build capacity in the National Health Service, that we weren't trying to eradicate the virus, we'd like to, of course, but that the goal of lockdown was to make sure that there was capacity, so if you did get severely sick, you'd be treated with dignity. You'd have access to the hospital, to doctors, to treatment, and the rest of it. It now seems that hospitalization and access to it has very little to do with the government's lockdown strategy. The government has not actually made clear why it's locking down certain local areas. We hear a lot about infection rates, but we don't know the exact metrics that they're using or combining to determine whether or not an area has to go into local lockdown. But one could infer, looking at Preston as a really good example, that they are focused on infection rates, because if you were focused on hospitalization rates, you would say, well, this is a huge success story. 4 COVID hospitalizations in the last day leading up to the week of the 5th of August. Yes, we saw infections go up, but that could be from testing, that could be from a myriad of things. Hospitalizations are at their lowest on record. But that's not being included. Preston still went into lockdown. So we need more information from the government about why they're choosing to lock down certain areas. We can infer a lot here, but it's not particularly transparent.
One of the arguments you hear quite a lot in Sweden is that it's actually a good thing if the disease is spreading widely amongst young people who don't get affected by it, because the more it spreads, the more likely you are to build up herd immunity, and therefore the more likely people are to be protected from it who don't have it. So again, I think it's unclear from the government, do they want to stop the spread of this, or are they worried if over 30s get it who don't even notice it? Because there are quite a few academic papers now saying that if it is spread amongst people who don't notice it or get minimal symptoms, then this is part of the natural spread of a virus. This is how societies shrug off a virus effectively. And retarding this process will simply drag out. This has been Sweden's argument all along, that you basically cannot game this. It's going to make its way through a society. And that the question is, how do you do this in a way which harms the fewest number of people? The Swedish strategy has been quite controversial, although the figures are looking a lot better for Sweden recently than they have been earlier on.
Although, Kate, there is an intergenerational point here as well, because even if young people don't suffer from this disease as much, obviously elderly people do. And Preston City Council has gone for a rather interesting approach in asking people to abide by the lockdown. Here's what Adrian Phillips, the chief executive of the City Council, had to say.
Our director of public health says, don't kill granny and to young people. And that to try and focus the message, young people inevitably are among the brave and the bold, aren't they? They want to be adventurous and out and about. But we know that they have the virus in are more likely to at the moment. They often have less symptoms, but they do take it back to their household.
Kate, what do you make of that message?
I think it will be relatively successful. What we saw in the national lockdown is that the vast majority of people were willing to sacrifice their own liberties and their own life for a time to make sure that they could protect other people, usually more vulnerable, older people, often that they didn't know. In the vast majority of cases, people they didn't know. So it's not just about your gran, it's about anybody else's gran. I do wonder how long that kind of messaging lasts, because I think the subtle implication there is, young people, this is a bit your fault. You do need to adhere to these rules very strictly, otherwise you will be responsible.
Morally speaking.
Now, I think that certainly worked during the national lockdown, but one has to wonder months into these restrictions if at some point the responsibility, it's not that it fully transfers from the community onto the government, but that perhaps if we had a comprehensive track and trace system, perhaps if we had had more testing earlier on, perhaps if the government was creating a circumstance in which it would be much easier to find out who has the virus so you can nip it in the bud in the beginning, that people could return to more normality. It is really horrid to ask young people for so long to put their lives on hold. Indeed, I think it's horrible to ask anybody to put their lives on hold. Often when you speak to the older generations, they're the most resistant to these lockdown measures. They want to live their lives, especially if they feel they only have a few years left to do it. So I'm sure the rhetoric will work for many people, but, you know, months in, potentially years in, at what point do you say actually to the people in charge, you need to get this under control, because it's not realistic to ask us to socially distance for an indefinite period of time?
Fraser, what does this mean for the government's approach to restrictions in coronavirus in general? Yesterday, we've seen that for the first time since June, over 1,000 people, 1,062 to be precise, tested positive for COVID-19. This comes on the back of Sage advisor Jeremy Farrar saying that we are nearly up at the upper end of the R budget, as in we can't ease out more without R increasing beyond one. What do you make of that?
Again, it's an interesting concept that the R number is something the government can control by how many restrictions it imposes on society. Again, this is a theory. It may well be right. It might not be. But we've seen no proof of this. Certainly, if a Leicester experiment is anything to go by, it is difficult to demonstrate, really, that locking down a town will put the R budget down. And also, the concept of an R budget is interesting. It's saying, okay, that there are some things that you can do to try to stop the spread of a virus. Are you going to close down a school? Are you going to tell people to stay at home? Are you going to stop mass gatherings? Again, this is more of the, as with everything, as with so much in COVID, people are just taking their best guess. So I still think that I don't know how many months in we are to this virus, and we still don't know what the government are looking for. The British Medical Association have called on the government to publish clear thresholds for when lockdown or other measures, national or local, will be imposed or released. And I think that's a very good point. The notion of an R budget is not one, as far as we know, that the government is adopting. I also personally think that the R number is an incredibly confusing way of discussing something fairly basic, which is whether the virus is going up or whether the virus is going down. I think it's far more clear for people to understand if it's in retreat or if it isn't. And of course, sure, there are levels of complexity, because as we were just discussing, spreading amongst young people is very different, especially if nobody gets seriously ill from that.
Although, Kate, some people would say better safe than sorry when it comes to a lockdown. If we don't understand it, then lock it down.
I think those are the two competing narratives that we've seen since the start of this crisis. How much risk are you willing to take on? And we must remember that our budget is deeply political. The government knows that many people think that it got its handling of the virus wrong at the beginning. Now, we can dispute that. I think there's actually growing evidence that a lot of the measures brought in before the official lockdown, social distancing, washing one's hands, did a lot of good to slowing the spread of the virus. But a lot of people still say the government locked down too late. A few weeks back, we saw that England has the highest number of excess deaths in Europe. There are major questions as to how the UK handled things in the first wave of COVID-19. So if there is to be a second wave or a third wave, the government is going to take a more cautious approach. And I think that's why we hear so much about the R budget. It's not just about the rate of infection. It's about signaling to the public that the government has this under control. And it does create a false dichotomy, say, between pubs and schools, when there's such limited evidence from around the world that young children actually pass on the virus to their teachers. To say, well, we'll shut down this pub so we can open the schools, you're implying that infection rates are the same amongst the same age groups, in the same atmosphere. And they're really not. The mounting evidence that we're getting is just that they're not. So I think it's political as much as it is public health oriented. And we must remember that when talking about this trade-off of risk and you know, better safe than sorry, sure, for how long? And what do you have to sacrifice in terms of life and what we know it means to be human and sociable and for how long?
We also have to question how safe lockdown is, because lockdown has its casualties in other ways. There are businesses which close down, people lose their jobs and livelihoods. That's a associated with an increase in all sorts of things. I mean, the full cost of lockdown, I think, is only beginning to be counted now, both nationally and globally. It could well be that the government has been engaging in what might come to be seen as reckless caution. Safe in terms of getting the number of COVID infections, or so they hope, but with side effects which might have led to more deaths than were saved. And that is, of course, the fundamental dilemma behind this. We can see and count the COVID deaths. What we can't see and what we can't count is the damage imposed by lockdown. It's going to be several years before we get that full picture.
Kate and Fraser, thanks very much. And to hear more from Kate on coronavirus, she has a daily lunchtime email where she crunches the numbers, including the numbers in today's podcast. So do subscribe to that at spectator.co.uk/COVID email, all one word. Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.